My name is Ben Greenfield, and on this episode of the Ben Greenfield Life Podcast.
The issue here, at least in part, is that we know the gut is a major source of acetaldehyde, and we know that the liver has a great solution for acetaldehyde, but at that point, it's maybe too late. And so basically the idea here is that we just took a safe, edible probiotic bacteria you already likely eat every day, whether or not you take probiotics, and it's ubiquitous in nature, so it's in the soil, and then we engineered it to express an enzyme very similar to the one your liver uses to convert the acetaldehyde to acetate the same way your liver does. And so the idea is you eat this probiotic before you drink, and then it's in your gut. And as acetaldehyde is forming in the gut, the bacteria are in there to help your body kind of deal with that acetaldehyde before it makes its way in the bloodstream.
Fitness, nutrition, biohacking, longevity, life optimization, spirituality, and a whole lot more. Welcome to the Ben Greenfield Life Show. Are you ready to hack your life? Let's do this. I've used it for years. It's one of my go-to nootropic blends because it's like brain food. It's vegan. It's non-GMO. Supports focus and memory and mental energy. 28 research-backed nootropics packed into one teeny tiny bottle. If you've appreciated my work for the last 7 years now, you can attribute a great deal of that to this nootropic. It's called Qualia Mind. Qualia Mind. It's fueled my brain for years now, and you feel it within days. I would say within hours after taking it. You can also try it with a 100% money-back guarantee and 15% off. Here's how. Go to neurohacker.com/BGF. And use code BGF at checkout. It's already up to 50% off. You get an extra 15% off the already discounted price and get to try it for 100 days with no financial risk, money-back guarantee, neurohacker.com, neurohacker.com/BGF to try Qualia Mind and get an extra 15% off. How do you like that? Last night, I got my shipment in. That's right. Paleo Valley sent me their fermented meat sticks, which are amazing. They're these beef sticks. I gave a few to some of my friends already, which they love. I actually interviewed Stephen Gundry on my podcast, and he talked about how when you look at a lot of these blue zones, the ones that are the highest ranking in terms of longevity eat meat, but the meat that they eat is actually fermented. And that's exactly what they've done with Paleo Valley. They've actually taken really good grass-fed, grass-finished beef. They've fermented, which naturally introduces gut-friendly probiotics, but more importantly, breaks down a lot of the sugars that would normally cause meat to be harmful, concentrates the vitamins, makes it more digestible, and they have fantastic flavors. They got the original. They've got one that's like a summer sausage. They have a garlic sausage. They have a teriyaki. It's probably my favorite. And you can now get your hands on fermented beef sticks that basically blow that Slim Jim beef jerky out of the water. So check out paleovalley.com/Ben. That's paleovalley.com/Ben to try out these beef sticks and get 15% off your order. Not just beef sticks, fermented beef sticks. Well, if you're tired of spending hours on cardio with minimal results, then listen up because I got a game-changing fitness breakthrough for you. The Carol Bike, science-backed, time-saving solution trusted by experts for optimizing health and longevity. They use a special form of a workout called a rehit, which allows you to achieve superior health and fitness benefits compared to regular cardio in 90% less time. That's amazing. That's a lot of time, 90%. Studies show that by doing Carol's 5-minute workout just 3 times a week, you can improve your fitness by 12%, reduce your risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and even wind back your internal body clock by 10 years. The science is clear. Carol Bike is your ticket to a healthier and more vibrant life. You got to try it to believe it and to see what I'm saying. I mean, it's not like a walk in the park. When you're pushing hard in those intervals, you're pushing, but then it's just like over and it's done and it walks you through it. It's very motivating. It's 5 feet away from me right now. It's right here in my office. My cool little exercise toy in my office. So you get $250 off your Carol Bike. You don't have to wait any longer. You can join over 25,000 riders and visit carolbike.com today. Carolbike.com. All right, folks. So as many of you know, I've not completely sworn off alcohol. I'm not on that longevity-enhancing bandwagon that says no cocktails. for the rest of your life. As a matter of fact, I'm not even really celebrating Sober October, at least not in a strict sense of the word. I like to have an organic glass of wine every now and again, or I should say a glass of organic biodynamic wine, if you want to be a true healthy biohacker. I love to have like bitters, like digestifs and aperitifs, and you know, a lot of these like wild crafted cocktails where I'll take Italian Ibo Libo, or one of my latest infatuations is Croatian Palankovic liqueur, and add a little bit of lemon and apple cider vinegar and sparkling water and make myself a cocktail at home. However, I will not deny that even in small amounts, alcohol can get converted into some things that long term might cause some issues in your tissues, so to speak. And even though I endorse responsible consumption of alcohol, I think it's helpful to have some things around that you can help to control the damage with. And so that's where the story of today's podcast begins, because my guest, his name is Zach Abbott. He actually was working at a research lab and came up with this crazy idea of engineering probiotic strains to actually help you digest alcohol better. That's my bastardized explanation. I know Zach's going to take a deep dive into the science today, but he's with this company called ZBiotics. He'll be able to explain exactly what it is and what it has to do with your desire to drink alcohol. Probably a good topic to be talking about during our approach to the holiday season. But anyways, Zach, welcome to the show, man.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks for having me. Thanks for having me. Excited to chat with you today.
Yeah, for sure. And I forgot to tell people during the introduction, but I'll put show notes for everything we talk about. If you're listening or watching, go to bengreenfieldlife.com/zpodcast, or if I'm cool and European, I could say bengreenfieldlife.com/zpodcast. And Zach, first of all, it is kind of interesting that your name starts with a Z and you're in charge of a company called ZBiotics. Is that personal? Do you actually name your company after yourself?
Yeah, unfortunately, it was meant to be a placeholder. Oh, really? Name.
I thought, by the way, maybe Z was like the alphabet letter soup for the specially engineered probiotic strain or something like that.
Right. It was kind of one of these things where, you know, I literally came up with the name in like 5 minutes when I was like planning up for a pitch competition. It was meant to be like a placeholder before I'd even started the company. And I thought, it's never become something, we'll change the name. And it's just something. But then we did a bunch of naming exercises after, you know, we were looking to launch the first product, and, you know, the name really worked. We owned it, and people kind of see Z as like a sciencey letter. And we're trying to launch, you know, we were launching the world's first ever genetically engineered probiotic of any kind to go to market. And so it sort of felt like a nice, unique name to kind of like, you know, be the flag bearer for genetically engineered probiotics as a category, sort of like ZBiotic. Forever it'll
you're,
be
you're right,
sort
by
of
the way,
my
Z,
name, but not intentional.
Yeah, Z does sound scientific. It's kind of like NASA or the Russians, right? Like anytime you drop something like that in a conversation about science, you become instantly credible. So I think we could throw Z into that equation too. Hey, million-dollar question though, before we get into what an engineered probiotic even is or how this came to be, do you actually drink? And if so, just to break the ice here, what's your cocktail of choice or your drink of choice?
I do drink, although definitely less, since starting running this company and, and the amount of work I have, it's sort of like I find myself having less and less time for sort of social activities. But yeah, when I do drink, I say my favorite cocktail, if I'm just relaxing, is a Boulevardier. I'd say my favorite cocktail, if I'm out having fun and socializing with friends, is probably whiskey soda. So
I have no clue what a Boulevardier is. Can you explain?
It's a Negroni, but with whiskey instead of gin.
Oh, okay. So the fast track for getting drunk as an Italian. I get it. I've had some experience with Negronis. Now, do you have any thoughts on this? I think probably Dr. Andrew Huberman, bless his heart, is largely responsible for this craze of people pretty much like swearing off alcohol completely. And of course, there's a surge in these alcohol replacement drinks that technically aren't alcohol, but, you know, a mix of different herbs and things like that. What do you think of this whole shift towards people just saying in general, alcohol is going to kill you no matter what?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, look, we know alcohol is not good for you. So if that works for you, I think it's obviously it's great. That being said, you know, I also think that for some people, a sort of an all or nothing solution is not sustainable. And that's okay too. You know, if you decide to drink alcohol, just choosing sort of responsible choices and drinking in moderation and, you know, anything you can do to basically kind of mitigate kind of the damage that we know alcohol always does for us. So, you know, look, if you're happy with sort of with full sobriety and don't feel like that impacts your life, then I think that's great. But a lot of people find that it's a, you know, normal and healthy part of a social adult social interaction and works as a sort of a social lubricant. It's something that's enjoyable for the flavor and that kind of uniqueness of the beverages. So I think that that's also okay. It's an important part of your psychological health in many cases when engaged in responsibly. And so, you know, I think to each their own.
Yeah, you obviously know way more about the interaction of alcohol with human physiology than I do, being steeped in the science of this, I suppose, and even developing, you know, probiotics to help the body deal with this. But what do you think about the notion of alcohol as a hormetic stressor, meaning like small, responsible amounts that don't get you inebriated, that you use in the same way you might use a wide variety of plants and herbs and spices, might have a little bit of a cellular resilience inducing effect, you know, just like this concept that things that could kill you in large doses, like spending 3 hours in the sauna or an hour in an ice bath, or, you know, eating a giant shopping cart full of kale might not be that great for you. Having little bits of alcohol might actually induce some kind of a hormetic stress. And the way I think about this, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this, is that a lot of times when alcohol gets thrown under the bus, it's because people are using large doses of it. And some of the studies don't really break out the difference between someone having, let's say, a small glass of wine with dinner each night and averaging based on that, maybe 7 drinks a week, and someone who's having like 7 drinks on a Saturday night and just flooding their body with those toxins.
Totally. I couldn't agree more that sort of lumping the behavior of drinking into sort of one broad category is definitely massively oversimplifying how humans engage with alcohol. And interestingly, you know, we see that some of the cultures that have, you know, the most longevity, alcohol is an important part of their diet. And in every single one of those cases, that alcohol is used in moderation. And so I think that it is a reasonable hypothesis. Obviously, that's correlative. So there's no real data to support that the alcohol itself is creating any form of longevity, but it's a reasonable hypothesis. And it's also reasonable to say that alcohol, when engaged in responsibly, is not necessarily going to be uniformly detrimental to longevity and kind of your overall health. And so I think it's an interesting idea. There's a lot more data that needs to be gathered here, because of the fact that, like you said, it's a perfect example, right? 7 drinks over 7 nights versus 7 drinks all in one night will have a very different effect on your health, even though both were the same amount of drinks in a week.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up that blue zones type of piece where you do look at a lot of these, you know, long-lived hot spots. And alcohol, you know, maybe the Seventh-day Adventist aside, seems to be a little bit of a staple. I think it's kind of contextual, though. It's like, if you're having a glass of wine or, you know, an aperitif or a digestif while surrounded by a bunch of people laughing and breaking bread and in a parasympathetic state and, you know, full of joy and social engagement, that's obviously different than like drinking 3 beers on the couch by yourself after a day of work while you watch Netflix to, you know, drink away a little bit of stress.
Absolutely. 100%. And I think that, I think, you know, that for me, that context is actually what's the most important part about it, right? That for many people, alcohol is a good kind of platform or, behavior that goes along with a lot of healthy social interaction. And so in some cases, sort of an effort to like go in these all or nothing, like sober October or dry January, kind of it also becomes socially isolating sometimes because people are like, well, I don't want to go out because I'm not drinking. That correlation in and of itself is maybe not all the most ideal. But I think that this concept of all or nothing puts people into situations where they're making kind of either or decisions, which I think can be a detrimental in its own way because psychological health is also fairly important.
Yeah, you'd be surprised the number of people I've run into who have said, well, I'm still going to go out and tie one on socially, but they're actually using psilocybin. I must have run into like 4 people in the past couple of months alone who are microdosing with psilocybin instead of drinking alcohol in the evening and just figuring out a different way to kind of spin the dials, you know?
Super interesting. Very, you know, I think that as we sort of, you know, culturally evolve and understand like the health effects of different sort of substances that we ingest, I think that, you know, we're going to find the ideal situation. And, you know, as long as we're committed to improving our health, both our biological health, but then also our psychological health and social health, all these things together, I think we're going to find some cool practices are going to emerge. I think that's great.
Yeah, done. This podcast is officially over. Drink responsibly with other people, not too much at a time, and use psilocybin occasionally. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Perfect.
No, I was kidding. So the interesting thing is that I think a lot of people might not realize what exactly is going on, you know, when you metabolize alcohol. Because from what I understand, it's not exactly the ethanol that's the issue. It's the byproducts that's being broken down into. Can you explain exactly what's going on and why alcohol would be problematic as far as its potential as a toxin?
Basically, you know, at the highest level, when you drink, you ingest the ethanol, right? And then that goes into your stomach and your intestines, and it's, you know, most of it's pretty rapidly absorbed into your bloodstream. The ethanol then circulates throughout your bloodstream and it has the effects that it has. And then it makes its way to the liver where it's, for all intents and purposes, from a detoxification standpoint, it's sort of broken down in 2 stages. So the ethanol gets converted into acetaldehyde using one enzyme, and then that acetaldehyde is subsequently broken down into acetate using a second enzyme. And then, so that acetate is essentially, you know, it's vinegar, it's innocuous. If anything, you know, it's a short-chain fatty acid, it can be beneficial. A lot of metabolic fates happen from acetate, but at that point, from a toxicity standpoint, your body has successfully detoxified the molecule. That intermediate acetaldehyde is highly toxic, much more toxic than ethanol itself. The good news is that your liver is very good at both of those reactions. And so very little of the acetaldehyde that forms in the liver actually makes its way into your bloodstream, and it's not really a source of acetaldehyde. That being said, what happens in the gut is a little bit different. So I said, you know, most of the alcohol is absorbed pretty quickly. That being said, some of the alcohol that makes its way into your gut is broken down directly in the gut, in large part by your microbiome. So the microbes that are living in your gut before it can be absorbed in the bloodstream. And so this is not a very significant amount of alcohol from a sort of intoxication perspective, but it actually becomes really important in terms of human health and the way you feel the next day, because this alcohol is converted into acetaldehyde, but then not subsequently into acetate like it is in the liver. And so even though it's a very small amount of alcohol that's being broken down in the gut, almost all of it is being converted into acetaldehyde and not acetate. And so the gut ends up being the major source of acetaldehyde in the body. And we see that in scientific literature, it's well established that colonic acetaldehyde levels are 5 to 10 times higher than blood acetaldehyde levels at any given time after a night of heavy drinking. And this acetaldehyde is highly soluble. It gets absorbed out of the gut into the bloodstream. It circulates throughout the body, sort of like wreaks havoc. Acetaldehyde causes can bind to DNA and bind to proteins and really junk up the gears in your cells and cause cell death, which causes systemic inflammation. Acetaldehyde can bind to receptors in your brain, which causes nausea and anxiety and all these different things. And then that acetaldehyde makes its way to the liver and it's broken down very efficiently in the liver. But at that point, it's kind of like too late. When you kind of wake up the next day and you feel miserable, acetaldehyde is a major culprit in that. It's not the whole story. There are other things that are happening. So the ethanol itself can basically bind to receptors in your brain, which is part of what causes the intoxication effects, but it also affects the quality of your sleep. And ethanol also affects a lot of your hormone balances. And so it affects the way you feel hunger and satiation. It affects the way your body deals with glucose. And so the glucose and insulin response, like all these things are affected. The next day you're kind of dealing with downstream effects of largely those two molecules. There's sort of like other very small things that happen that contribute a little bit, but those are, it's kind of like the major story is kind of like those two molecules. And so those are kind of like the key elements of what your body is dealing with.
Those two molecules, namely being acetate and acetaldehyde.
Ethanol and acetaldehyde.
Ethanol,
we get to acetate, we're pretty happy once we get to acetate. Yeah.
Okay. Is there like a dose dependent effect? Meaning if you drink a certain amount, do you wind up kind of like overloading the liver with acetaldehyde or ethanol that gets converted into acetaldehyde? And then at that point, it begins to accumulate in the gut? Or is there always some accumulating in the gut, some accumulating in the liver, and it's just the stuff in the gut that we want to worry about the most?
Yeah, I mean, so for most people, the reaction from acetaldehyde to acetate is as fast or faster than the reaction from ethanol to acetaldehyde. In the liver. And so usually you're not going to overwhelm the acetaldehyde breakdown. So you can't overwhelm the whole system by drinking a lot, right? And like your liver can't keep up. And so you're exposed to this alcohol for longer. But in terms of gut acetaldehyde, that is very dose dependent. So the more alcohol you drink, the more acetaldehyde is going to form in your gut, the more that's going to get out in your bloodstream and sort of wreak havoc before it makes its way to the liver. So definitely and it's not even just the volume, it's also the volume per unit time, right? So drinking three shots in succession is going to overwhelm your system much faster than drinking, you know, three glasses of wine over the course of 3 hours, right? Or something like that.
Yeah, that makes sense. And obviously we aren't even talking about other contaminants that you might find in your drink of choice. Like if you're having the $2 margarita special with the high fructose corn syrup, or consuming that something that has processed sugars, the espresso martini with that potent combination of caffeine and alcohol. There's a lot of other considerations besides the acetaldehyde, but I guess I'm hypothesizing here that my healthy, responsible listeners are already choosing high fructose corn syrup free and, you know, non-preservative laden sources of alcohol. So now the main thing they need to worry about is just the acetaldehyde.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, you evaluate those risks like you would any other time, right? Like independent of the alcohol, right? Like the other things that are in there that, you know, you have to make your own kind of decision about what you want to do with those. But yeah, definitely, right? Like high sugar, high fructose corn syrup. Caffeine is actually really interesting when mixed with alcohol. There's good data to show that it reduces sort of your risk tolerance, risk aversion, synergistically, even more so than the alcohol itself. And so people who drink caffeine and alcohol are more likely to make really bad decisions, like drinking and driving, or more likely to kind of, you know, engage in risky behaviors that they wouldn't normally do. So definitely strongly, encourage people to really, really be considerate about whether or not they should be having caffeine with alcohol.
That was the original impetus for, I think, some nightclubs, I believe it was in Europe, kind of outlawing that Red Bull vodka phenomenon, not only for the reasons you stated, but from what I understand, it increases risk for things like stroke, atrial fibrillation, et cetera, which is kind of funny because I know a handful of folks who will nod their heads in agreement that, oh yeah, Red Bull vodka, and then they'll sip their highfalutin, refined espresso martini at martini bar. It's pretty much the same thing as caffeine and alcohol, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So when it comes to what we can do about this, particularly the acetaldehyde, you have a unique approach. And I'd love to hear a little bit more about the science of how you could do some micro adjustments to the microbiome and actually equip the gut to better be able to deal with acetaldehyde. So obviously kind of like a loaded question based on your history with engineering probiotic strains, but I'd love to hear you get into this. We got time.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, look, I'll start by saying kind of like the high level and then kind of dig in right a little bit that, as I said, I mean, the issue here, at least in part, is that we know the gut is a major source of acetaldehyde. And we know that the liver has a great solution for acetaldehyde, but at that point it's maybe too late. And so the idea that we could deal with acetaldehyde in the gut seemed like a pretty, you know, pretty straightforward idea as a way to kind of deal with some of the effects that drinking could have on kind of your next morning. And so it was, you know, in looking at that problem, so, you know, my PhD is in microbiology. I study bacterial gene regulation. I know that there's a lot of bacteria living in your gut. There's a lot of bacteria in your food that passes through your gut. And, you know, we take probiotics, which are live, edible bacteria. And so this felt like a really great mechanism for delivering that function of the liver into the gut. So, you know, bacteria perform, say, like 3,000 biological functions, and most of those functions are for the purpose of the bacteria, right? And so then sometimes, sort of tangentially, some of those functions could be useful to people. And so the idea that we could apply genetic engineering to ensure that one additional function was added to a bacteria that could create a known kind of function or benefit for us universally was kind of the idea behind Zbiotics generally, that we could just basically take a probiotic that we know is capable of kind of performing these biological functions in the body and ensure that it performs a function that we find useful. And so then kind of looking around for applications of that, you know, the knowledge that acetaldehyde in the gut is important for the way you feel after drinking, then I thought like this would be a great kind of application of the technology, prove out the concept and of genetically engineered probiotics in a way that people could understand and really feel for themselves. And so that's where we started. And so basically the idea here is that we just took a safe, edible probiotic bacteria you already likely eat every day, whether or not you take probiotics. It's ubiquitous in nature, it's in the soil. And then we engineered it to express an enzyme very similar to the one your liver uses to convert the acetaldehyde to acetate the same way your liver does. And so the idea is you eat this probiotic before you drink, and then it's in your gut. And as acetaldehyde is forming in the gut, the bacteria are in there to help your body kind of deal with that acetaldehyde before it makes its way in the bloodstream. And so that's really at the highest level, kind of like this, the approach we took.
I've used it for years. It's one of my go-to nootropic blends because it's like brain food. It's vegan. It's non-GMO. Supports focus and memory and mental energy. 28 research-backed nootropics packed into one teeny tiny bottle. If you've appreciated my work for the last 7 years now, you can attribute a great deal of that to this nootropic. It's called Qualia Mind. Qualia Mind. It's fueled my brain for years now. And you feel it within days. I would say within hours after taking it. You can also try it with a 100% money-back guarantee and 15% off. Here's how. Go to neurohacker.com/BGF and use code BGF at checkout. It's already up to 50% off. You get an extra 15% off the already discounted price and get to try it for 100 days with no financial risk, money-back guarantee, neurohacker.com. neurohacker.com/BGF to try Qualia Mind and get an extra 15% off. How do you like that? Last night, I got my shipment in. That's right. Paleo Valley sent me their fermented meat sticks, which are amazing. They're these beef sticks. I gave a few to some of my friends already, which they love. I actually interviewed Stephen Gundry on my podcast, and he talked about how when you look at a lot of these blue zones, the ones that are the highest ranking in terms of longevity eat meat, but the meat that they eat is actually fermented. And that's exactly what they've done with Paleo Valley. They've actually taken really good grass-fed, grass-finished beef. They've fermented, which naturally introduces gut-friendly probiotics, but more importantly, breaks down a lot of the sugars that would normally cause meat to be harmful, concentrates the vitamins, makes it more digestible, and they have fantastic flavors. They got the original. They've got one that's like a summer sausage. They have a garlic sausage. They have a teriyaki. It's probably my favorite. And you can now get your hands on fermented beef sticks that basically blow that Slim Jim beef jerky out of the water. So check out paleovalley.com/Ben. That's paleovalley.com/Ben to try out these beef sticks and get 15% off your order. Not just beef sticks, fermented beef sticks.
So you're basically turning the gut into a giant liver.
I mean, in a way, yeah. Or like a liver outpost maybe, yeah.
Well, talk about playing God, but obviously people, I think, all joking aside, hear you yeah. say something like genetic engineering and their eyeballs pop out, you know, especially people in the health sector, because apparently anything genetically engineered could be, you know, very risk prone, not have a lot of long-term safety data behind it. So, you know, how do you address this idea that, you know, people are avoiding genetically engineered foods, yet, you know, you're hawking this genetically engineered probiotic that digests acetaldehyde for you? What do you say to people who are concerned about the safety issues here?
Totally. And like, I appreciate very much the concern that exists around genetic engineering. I think what's the problem has been is that the technology has been conflated with some of its applications. So what I mean by that is that a lot of people are scared about GMOs and upset about GMOs because of the way they've been used. So, you know, there is a large debate in this country, and rightfully so, around like the safety of, like, for instance, like Roundup Ready corn, right? Like this idea that we can add more pesticides to our fields if we have this corn that's resistant to the pesticide. And so the fact that the strain is of corn is genetically engineered is not inherently what makes the product unsafe. The fact that we are adding more pesticides to our field maybe is what the problem is, right? Or like, is the debate of the problem, right? Is like, is this Roundup unsafe for our health and for ecological health? I think there's very reasonable arguments on that. And so unfortunately, the technology that enabled that that business practice has been conflated with the safety issue itself. But the fact that we've genetically engineered it has no effect on its safety whatsoever. It's just a technology. It's a tool to make final products. And the analogy I often use for this is that, you know, there's also a hot debate in this country around guns and gun control. And I think that regardless of what side of the aisle you are on that conversation, odds are good that you're not saying that we shouldn't use metallurgy, the technology used to make the gun, right? Because we recognize that metallurgy could also make a spoon, which is a very safe, right, product that has. And so it's really a technology that enables kind of products. And so we should evaluate the safety of the product, not the technology used to make it. And with genetic engineering, I think that, so that's a tool that can be used to make, you know, all kinds of products, safe or unsafe. And I think that there's some sort of misconceptions around what genetic engineering is. You sort of mentioned like kind of playing God. And in reality, I mean, I think that gives scientists a little too much credit. Like we aren't doing, you know, we're basically what genetic engineering is we now have a increased understanding, better understanding than we did 20, 30 years ago about how life already alters its own DNA. And now because we understand that better, we can guide that process more directly and more efficiently. So, you know, 200, 300 years ago, we were doing the same thing of trait transfer with plant crossbreeding. And it's a natural process that plants do. And they essentially like mash all their DNA together and a bunch of traits cross over. And then we select for the plant that has the traits that we want, like a juicier fruit or, you know, a better color or whatever it might be. It's a very imprecise process. Plants are relatively new to the game of gene transfer. Bacteria are 2 to 3 times, you know, 2 or 3 billion or 2 or 3 billion years older than plants. So bacteria are much better at kind of editing their own DNA. And we've come to understand how bacteria do that. And they do it very effectively, very efficiently. And so now that we understand that process, we can guide that process better in the lab. And so right now, what I do for genetic engineering is I literally just mix live bacteria with DNA. And then the bacteria will take up that DNA on its own using processes it's already evolved to do. It will then match that DNA to its own existing chromosome and swap that DNA in to its own chromosome. It does all that itself. And it knows how to do all that. So like, I'm not really doing a lot. I'm just sort of facilitating a natural activity. And that is genetic engineering. And when I do that, that creates a GMO. And so the process does not make the bacteria unsafe in any way. It's a question of what that DNA is and how that affects the bacteria, whether or not it's going to be unsafe. And so with our first product, we genetically engineered the bacteria to express an enzyme that is present in 70% of all life on the planet, including many of the bacteria that are already in your gut. You know, your liver cells make this enzyme, and many of the bacteria that are in the soil that the bacteria already naturally engages with have this enzyme. And so all we're doing is making sure that you're getting enough of a very common enzyme at the right time and in the right place. But nothing we've introduced into this is unseen by the bacteria or by your gut or by the external environment. So obviously the product we're creating is very safe because we're not introducing anything new. It's really about a matter of optimizing for a specific use case of human health that nature didn't have any incentive to optimize for before. So, you know, when you think about the end product, that's really kind of the question about whether or not a product is safe or unsafe.
Okay. And not to excessively stereotype here, but you hear about like the red-faced Asian businessman who literally is very red-faced after, say, quaffing a few beers. And the reason that I understand that that's the case is because they lack a certain enzyme. I believe it is something like a dehydrogenase enzyme or something like that, that breaks down the alcohol. Is that the same enzyme that you're genetically engineering a probiotic strain to produce?
Essentially, yeah. So the enzyme that the liver uses to convert, right, it's called acetaldehyde dehydrogenase. So it's basically the enzyme that the liver uses to convert the acetaldehyde into acetate is mutated in certain people. And that mutation is most common in sort of like people of East Asian descent. And so what happens there is that the alcohol you drink, that makes its way to the liver and is processed in the liver. The alcohol is processed into acetaldehyde, but then that second step from acetaldehyde to acetate is not very efficient. And so you get this massive kind of dose of acetaldehyde. Acetaldehyde, among many other effects it has, is also a vasodilator. And so it causes the blood vessels to swell, which creates, you know, more blood kind of rushing to the surface and skin. And so that's why you get that flushing reaction. And that's due to a huge exposure to acetaldehyde, which also has kind of other undesirable effects beyond just the flushing. And so, but most people have a functional version of that enzyme. They don't have that flushing reaction unless they drink a lot of alcohol, at which point the acetaldehyde that's building up in their gut.
Everybody will get a little bit of a red face. It's just some people don't make as much of the dehydrogenase, so it might set in earlier. I think I should name, by the way, that another issue that I'm aware of that can cause that red face is histamine sensitivities, which you can genetically test. And a lot of people nowadays, including me, I've started to do this, will take like a natural antihistamine prior to alcohol consumption if you have poor histamine pathways. There's a genetic testing company, I don't know if you've heard of it, Zach, it's called Stratagene, and they test you for all these so-called dirty genes, like your nitric oxide pathways, your glutathione pathways, etc. And one of my pathways that's heavily dirtied is my histamine pathway. And a lot of high histamine foods would include fermented foods, canned fish like sardines, that's a biggie. Alcohol, you know, particularly things like wine and beer, or even kombucha would be pretty high up on the totem pole too when it comes to histamine producing compounds. And so I think an antihistamine seems like a pretty good solution as well. And as a matter of fact, when I drink, I've been using, I have a whole stack. So I take a little bit of glutathione later on. I've been taking a shot of your Z-biotics prior, but then I also use a little bit of an antihistamine as well. It sounds like a desperate attempt to be able to get away with alcohol consumption, but you know, I'm all about a little better living through science if you're going to have a couple glasses of wine, you know.
That's exactly right. I mean, like, you know, I think you could call it desperation. I think it's like, you know, look, we're leveraging the tools we know as we understand the biology better and better. What's interesting about antihistamines is that most of them actually have a sort of, I guess you call it a side effect that they're vasoconstrictors. And so that also sort of masks that symptom of the vasodilation of acetaldehyde. So that's sort of another reason why sometimes people who do have a flushing reaction find that antihistamines can help. That being said, that's really a combating symptoms rather than you're still being exposed to acetaldehyde. It's just, it's not causing a vasodilation now.
Yeah. Yeah. Considering another hack that people use is the activated charcoal, you know, carbon type of absorbent post-alcohol consumption. Yeah. I think the main reason I'm not a huge fan of that solution and why I like, you know, using Z-biotics and throwing a little bit of glutathione and antihistamine in the mix too is the activated charcoal basically absorb any other supplements you take, including anything you might take to help you sleep better, like your you know, favorite sleep supplement. And then it can also kind of make you constipated as well. So even though I think it does a good job absorbing toxins, I mean, you're talking about just like allowing your body to produce the enzymes in the gut biome that digest the acetaldehyde anyways, seems like a pretty good solution.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, actually charcoal is a pretty interesting one because that's sort of a thought experiment that didn't work, right? Like, so when you go into the hospital with like, you know, poisoning and often alcohol poisoning, they'll pump you full of activated charcoal, but like, it's like a kilogram. And so the volume in those pills of activated charcoal is, you know, on paper and in practice is shown to not have, you know, the absorbing amount is way like massively, thousands of times
too small. Huh. I didn't realize it was that much smaller than what they use in the hospital. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, they like literally, like say, I mean, like those pills are whatever, like a few grams, and we're talking like a kilogram or two. There are papers showing that like activated charcoal has like absolutely no effect. And so it was sort of one of these things where like somebody's like, oh, well, we use this in an extreme scenario. Maybe it'll help in kind of this other one. So I would encourage, I think many of the things you mentioned, I think do have good scientific hypotheses around them, but you know, with activated charcoal, I think we can be pretty confident that, and your point though, the problem, right, is quantity, right? That like, when you're trying to match, like absorption is one molecule, right? Like that they interact on a one-to-one scale. That's the ratio, right? The stoichiometry is very ineffective. So you have to have like this presence of it the whole time, right? That all the outside is being formed for the hours that you're drinking, you have to have this molecule also present in sufficient quantities to facilitate binding. And so that's fundamentally why we went to a biological approach. So rather than sort of having a one-to-one ratio in a chemical reaction, which we've shown throughout, you know, the 6,000 years of human history that people have been drinking, that they haven't been able to find sort of like a chemical in nature that can one-to-one deal with this problem, is we went to an enzymatic approach. So the idea that one enzyme of acetaldehyde dehydrogenase is a machine. It can continue to break down more and more acetaldehyde, every molecule that it engages with. So it's a much more powerful solution. Like one can break down many. And so, and then if we put in a bacteria, which is an enzyme factory, we can make, you know, I was going to say a number. I can't even say the number. I mean, it's, you know, millions or billions of these machines, of these enzymes that can all break down, you know, molecules of acetaldehyde. So we get a massive exponential extrapolation of kind of the effect of acetaldehyde breakdown when we go into biology instead of chemistry.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Now you said that when you make the Z-biotics, that you take a probiotic strain and then you mix it with DNA. Where are you getting the DNA?
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, that's, I think where the art meets the science, right? That like, we want to design a piece of DNA that will basically integrate, you know, leveraging the bacterial ability to kind of integrate the DNA into its genome. We can basically direct where that happens by the way we design the DNA. And so, in the last 10 to 15 years, we've gotten very good at sort of like reading and writing DNA. And so we can basically make short strings of DNA using chemistry. And then we can design exactly where we want it to go in the genome. And we can make sure that like that edit is extremely precise. And we know exactly what kind of what's happening, as opposed to like the plant crossbreeding, where you're just sort of like mashing together whole genomes and kind of don't really have any control where that happens. So right now we literally can, you know, you can just order that DNA, that strip of DNA to be made. The design of it. And so if it's not well designed, it's not going to integrate. There is like the bacteria need the DNA to look very similar to their own DNA, or else they're not going to integrate it. And so we have to design DNA that is very similar to DNA they already have. And then we include the trait we want in that strip in a part of that DNA. And then the bacteria are able to kind of integrate that.
How do you make DNA? Are you just like stringing together the A, the G, the D and the T, different nucleic acids?
Yeah. So luckily I don't have to make the DNA. There are many companies that are, you know, very good at synthesizing DNA, but yeah, I mean, fundamentally it's like writing, it's composing, sort of, they're just sticking the nucleic acids together in an appropriate sequence. And so we've gotten very good at doing that very efficiently. The synthetic biology community, not we as in Z-biotics, I've gotten very good at, synthesizing DNA, you know, pretty efficiently, so that we can sort of do these projects now.
Yeah. How do you know it's safe though? I mean, how do you know I'm not going to grow a third arm in my gut, you know, from consuming something that's been genetically engineered?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, first and foremost, there's no reasonable expectation that would be the case, right? The fact that like the string of letters of DNA that's the instructional code for the bacterial cell. And so whether like the code itself, it's like, you know, that's not going to have any effect on you as a human. It's just DNA. You eat all kinds of DNA and all kinds of different, you know, conformations all the time. And so
yeah, that's true. If you eat meat, you're eating DNA, right?
Absolutely. If you eat anything, you basically, that comes from a living cell, right? If you eat meat, you eat plants, you eat mushrooms, any of that, it's all DNA, right? And all of the code that we're talking about is in those cells that you're eating. And so it's really just like us putting them into different cells. And so the question about safety would be not in the actual act of genetic engineering, it's in like what is the outcome? What does that cell look like at the end? What does it do? And is that unsafe in some way? And so basically, like, what functions are you affecting? And so the two ways to ask that question, or the two kind of major considerations, I think, is, like, first and foremost, is the literal function you are putting in unsafe? So in this case, like, the fact that we're programming the cell now to break down acetaldehyde, is that in some way unsafe? And then the second sort of, like, kind of more broad question is the fact that the bacteria is now able to perform that function, does that affect something else in its genome that would then make it unsafe? And so those are kind of like the two questions you have to ask when you're, again, like, the tool made the product. Now we have to ask, is that product safe or unsafe?
Right.
It can't mutate you. That's not, like, how this works. That's not how, you know, genetics works. And the fact that we've mutated it in some way does not mean that now it can mutate you. So it's really about, like, what function does it perform? And so there's many things we do to test for safety in terms of, like, is this product now safe? Is the function that's performing unsafe, or is it affecting some other function that would make it unsafe? And so at that point now, we're like, it's the same as if we find a new strain of bacteria in the wild and we want to give that as a probiotic, or if we sort of, like, crossbreed and make a new fruit. Like, we want to make sure that, like, did we, again, that's just another way of kind of changing its DNA in some way. And we've been doing that for hundreds of years intentionally, and thousands of years sort of, like, kind of unintentionally. So at that point, right, we evaluate the safety of the product the same everywhere, right? Like, we look at toxicity, we look at allergenicity, you know, pathogenicity, we look at all those things that are the standard kind of battery of tests. We do them to an extreme level. We address the genetic engineering and make sure that we're not, you know, we're not disrupting something in a way that, like, could create a problem. So, for instance, like, some techniques for genetic engineering involve using antibiotic resistance cassettes, and so, or, like, mobile genetic elements, so pieces of DNA that are intended to kind of move around. And so, you know, we make sure that we don't, you know, use any of those kind of, like, things that could cause ecological problems, right? So we don't use antibiotic resistance cassettes. We don't use mobile genetic elements in the final product or anything like that. So all those things are just best practices that eliminate kind of the risks that are innate or inherent to genetic engineering. What we end with is something that we know looks like anything else we would test. And then we do all the standard safety testing that we would do for any other kind of standard food.
Okay, that's good that you do safety testing. Although you did just shatter my pipe dreams of becoming some kind of mutated Zed-biotic superhero and getting some spidey
look,
sense.
We can, after yeah, back we can game plan how to do that later.
Sure, your secret Batman labs. Hey, so you talked about antibiotics briefly there. And it is interesting because, you know, I was looking into Acromantia bacterial strain recently and interviewed Colleen Cutcliffe from Pendulum. And they've created a process in their lab that's basically just like an oxygen-free series of tubes like the human gut to make an Acromantia strain that helps to control blood sugar and digestion of fibers. There's another product I'm aware of. I forget the name of it, but like Acromantia, you got to load with it for a few weeks to really start to see the beneficial effects. It's a lactate digesting enzyme that you take multiple rounds of over the course of a week to gradually load your gut up with what it needs to digest lactose, the sugar and dairy. Now, with your product, with Zbiotics, do you need to kind of like load with it for a certain period of time and use it consistently? That's kind of part one of this two-parter. And the second is, if you were kind of doing that and you got an antibiotics regimen, would it kind of like wipe everything out and you got to start from scratch?
Yeah. So one of the things like you mentioned Acromantia, it's a really interesting probiotic. The way that it functions, or the way that it, you know, it is required to function, is it basically has to take up residence in your gut. And that can be really difficult because everybody's microbiome is different, right? So your microbiome and mine are totally different. And your microbiome today and your microbiome in 3 months will be very different. And so the idea that something can get into kind of, regardless of the different communities we all have in our gut, the idea that like a single microbe can kind of get in there and have a beneficial effect is really difficult to do. And for the most part, this is why there is no FDA-approved drug that's probiotic-based at the moment, because that consistency is incredibly hard to get. Mm. And so you'll load it, like you say, loading up your gut for weeks or months on end is kind of like your best hope. And with a strain like Acromantia, the good news is that many people's microbiomes already have it. And so there is a kind of like space or a niche for that to hopefully seed your gut. It's not going to happen for everybody, but it's a much higher probability than say like lactobacillus, which for most adults is, which is by the way, the most, one of the most common probiotics. Most adults do not have lactobacillus in their gut, or at least not in significant numbers. And so this idea that, and really the reason why it's a probiotic is because it's a leftover of the dairy industry, not because it's good for human health. And so the idea that it can have kind of a benefit is pretty weak hypothesis. Like Akkermansia has a stronger one. It's more present, more common. But generally speaking, this is a huge problem, right? It's a big challenge. And as a microbiologist, I was well aware of this when we started Zbiotics. And so I decided I wanted to design something that could sort of sidestep that complexity, that weren't worried about what was happening in our microbiome since it was such a huge and complex problem. And so instead, I chose a bacteria called Bacillus subtilis, which is something that you likely eat every day of your life. It's ubiquitous in nature. It's on the surface of fresh fruits and vegetables, is on the surface of your countertops, all these things. And so it goes in your body all the time, and its natural life cycle is to pass through your gut. So even though you eat it every day, if you were to sequence your microbiome, you would find very little or no B. subtilis in it as a permanent resident, a transient member. And so by that mechanism, it passes through everybody's gut kind of the same. So we don't actually have to seed the gut. And I actually think that's a good thing, because your microbiome and my microbiome are very different. They may both be very healthy. And so the idea of like kind of trying to muscle something in there could disrupt the balance that your microbiome, the ecosystem that your microbiome already has, and that homeostasis. And so we pick something that your gut is very used to seeing that does not see the gut. And so for that perspective, we don't have to load up your gut to take advantage. It's basically the idea that as this bacteria is kind of floating down the river, it's expressing this enzyme, and the enzyme is what's useful to you, right? Not like kind of the other things that the bacteria is doing. And then you pass it out the other side, and the function is no longer there. And so then if you drink again, you have to take the product again, because we don't want to seed the gut. And so then therefore, the idea of like an antibiotic disrupting it is not really an issue, because it's not taking up residence in the gut. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Take your amoxicillin like candy, folks. You're not going to do any harm. Maybe.
Don't do that.
So the Bacillus subtilis that you called it, you couldn't just consume the fruits and vegetables and compounds that contain it, and then it would produce the acetaldehyde dehydrogenase. You'd still have to have a strain that had been modified in the way that you guys modify it in your lab.
Exactly. Bacillus subtilis doesn't naturally express this enzyme. Different strains potentially might, but they definitely don't. Like, so our engineering was large. So the platform we built was about like getting a lot of enzyme expression in the conditions of the gut. So bacteria turn on and on. This is what I studied in my PhD, was how bacteria turn on and off different genes in different conditions, right? So if a bacteria finds itself in a place where there's lots of nutrients, it will turn on metabolism and growth genes, and it'll turn off some of its other important functions that it doesn't need in that moment. But then if it gets stressed out or attacked by another bacteria, it'll turn off its metabolism genes and turn on like, you know, fight or flight mechanisms. And so it's really, really amazing. Bacteria are incredible biosensors, and they can kind of react to very fine differences in their environment. And so what we had to do was engineer bacteria that when it's in the gut would make a lot of the protein that we wanted and not turn that off in favor of something else. And so we engineered this strain of bacteria to make sure that it was making a lot of that acetaldehyde dehydrogenase enzyme as it went through your gut, so that you have that enzyme when you need it. Like many of the bacteria in your gut are capable and do make this acetaldehyde dehydrogenase enzyme. It's just they're not making it necessarily at the right time and in the right amount. And so you don't necessarily get the benefit of that enzyme. And so we're just making sure you're getting enough of that enzyme at the right time.
Yeah, you wouldn't believe the times the past couple of months that I've been to a party or a social event and handed out a few bottles of these, and my friends have texted me the next morning and been like, dude, where do I get that stuff? I feel great this morning. You know, the same friends who are drinking, frankly, a lot more than I do. And I've always told them, like, take a shot of this. It's a little liquid shot, the Zbiotic stuff, for those of you listening who haven't seen it yet. And I tell them to drink it, because I think this is what the label said, right before you start drinking. But what if you forget? Could you still drink it after and it would work?
So it helps best before. And so like, and so it depends on what you mean by like, kind of like after, right? So if you drink like two drinks and you're like, oh, you know what? I should drink my Zbiotics. This night might be a little bit more. And so you drink a Zbiotics and then you have like two or three more drinks. It'll help most with those two or three more drinks you have after, right? If you drink like four or five drinks, let's say, and then you go home and you take it before bed, I mean, at that point, a lot of the acetaldehyde that formed in the gut is probably already been absorbed in the bloodstream. And so
good point.
If you take a probiotic, our probiotic, and it gets in there, it can help with what's left in the gut. But anything that's out in the bloodstream, I mean, some of that will cycle back into the gut and we'll have a second pass at it. So it'll help. It's just you're really getting kind of, you're not getting the full benefit of the product at that point.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. So do you, like I mentioned, I'll use glutathione sometimes because I like that for helping the liver detoxification pathways.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And so do you stack the Z-Biotics thing or like in your own personal protocol or just in terms of alcohol management as a whole? Is there anything besides this myopic focus on alcohol dehydrogenase that you implement when drinking or that you recommend?
Totally. I think that it's really important that like we do not claim, nor should anybody claim that they have like this magical kind of cure-all, get-out-jail-free card, right? That like stacking a lot of responsible habits and behaviors together. Yeah.
Well, that's why you're not a billionaire yet, Zach. Sorry.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I gotta, so the deal is that there's a lot, you know, what you're dealing with when you drink, there's a lot of things happening in your body. There's a lot of biology happening there. And so you have to, there are different things that kind of that you need to address. And so to your point, glutathione is a great way to kind of reload the cofactors and enzymes that cofactors of the enzymes that are functioning in your liver and systemically and in your gut. And so there is some good data as a reasonable hypothesis behind that. I think that for me, the biggest problems are really sleep and this gut drive acetaldehyde, as I've discovered for myself. So Z-Biotics, and then I make sure that I'm pacing myself and I stop drinking earlier so that like I'm not dealing with the alcohol disruption in my sleep. I ideally like to go to bed sober or close to it so that most of the alcohol's effect on sort of like the sleep-wake cycle as I'm trying to sleep is mitigated so that I can get better sleep. And then I think those two things for me.
That's a good point because you get that surge in gamma-aminobutyric acid, the GABA,
exactly.
An inhibitory neurotransmitter from the alcohol, then it just kind of wears off. Same thing if you eat like a real high-carb meal before bed, you'll go hyperglycemic. And then as soon as your blood sugar drops, you know, sometime between midnight and 2 a.m. usually, you wake up with a cortisol release to mobilize more glucose. And similar with GABA, like once it wears off, you get a great 2 or 3 hours of sleep. Anybody who drinks kind of knows this. Then you wake up at like 1 and the rest of the night of sleep is pretty crappy. Although you can hack that by just having some sort of GABA precursor next to your bedside and dosing up with that. But you're right. The like stopping the alcohol consumption several hours prior to bed really helps out with that GABA rebound.
That's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, basically, yeah, you're dealing with this big pendulum swing, right? Like, and like while you sleep, which is pulling you out of your sleep cycle, then dropping you back in it. And like, so you really get crappy sleep when you kind of let that kind of chaos ensue while you're asleep. So the earlier you can work through that, the better. And the more you sort of pace yourself, the less loaded up that pendulum is, right? Like the slower, the smaller the swings are. So I think that those are sort of important behaviors that I kind of include alongside Z-Biotics.
Yeah. You think there's anything to this idea that certain forms of alcohol are cleaner than others, like high fructose corn syrup and fillers and preservatives aside, like a lot of people say Mezcal, for example, is very clean. I know a lot of people in like the paleo and health sectors who swear by the Mezcal tequila, other people or the Mezcal tequila. Some people say vodka and gin are more clean. Obviously organic biodynamic wine seems to be pretty favored due to the lack of sulfites and preservatives. But do you think there's anything to this idea of certain forms of alcohol being cleaner? Or does that affect your choices at all?
I mean, I think that at that point, you're getting into kind of incremental differences that may or may not have an impact depending on your own personal biology. So I think cleanliness, when we think about different kinds of alcohol, might be the fact that like basically in the fermentation process that makes the alcohol and then in like the distillation process that makes the liquor, there are byproducts of like, so in particular the fermentation that can affect the flavor and often in really pleasing ways. So like, for instance, like one of the byproducts of fermentation of wine that's really common is actually acetaldehyde itself. And so in addition to the acetaldehyde you're creating as sort of like the metabolic process of the alcohol, there is like sometimes in certain, so like red wine has a really high amount of acetaldehyde like the cup itself.
Huh.
And so that has a nice aroma and it sort of like creates like sort of like a sweet flavor. And there are other sort of like aromatics that are byproducts that basically that the bacteria or the yeast make as part of the fermentation process, which affect the flavor in ways that we enjoy a lot of times. And sometimes they affect flavor in ways we don't. And like, you know, this is what the art of kind of brewing and fermentation are. And so your body might have a reaction to a certain congener that somebody else doesn't have the same. It's the same as like, you know, like hay fever or another allergy or something, right? That like, you know, you mentioned like sulfites and, you know, these are things that some people might react to and some people don't. So I think that the cleanliness of the alcohol in general, it's an oversimplification, but in general, clear or light colored alcohols have less congeners than darker colored alcohols.
Okay. Okay. That's probably the logic behind like the gin, tequila, vodka type of argument.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, you know, brandy we know has a ton of congeners. And so there is like some, it is very, but generally speaking, the correlation between that and like the severity of the way you feel the next day are, there's not good data to support that that actually has a huge impact. And so I think that for the most part, like with anything, this is very personal. So if you notice that something has sort of an outsized negative effect for you, that's probably because that's how that alcohol interacts with your individual biology more than like kind of being a general rule of thumb.
Yeah, that makes sense. Man, I got to stock up on more Z-Biotics for the holiday drinking season here. Again, not that I endorse irresponsible drinking, but I think it's a good idea to have a few bottles of this around. You know, are you guys, oh, and I, by the way, I should mention when we were talking about solutions, I forgot two things. I'm super strict about minerals / electrolytes / hydration before and leading up to drinking just because of the increased urination that occurs from the diuretic effect of alcohol. So that's one. And then the other one I like is, when I'm drinking water, if I'm drinking or I'm going to drink, I like hydrogen tablets. It's kind of like this selective antioxidant. That one kind of flies under the radar. I don't know if you've messed around with that at all, Zach, but I've done a few very interesting podcasts on hydrogen that you can dissolve in water. And it seems to have a really great anti-inflammatory effect that makes alcohol feel a little bit better, especially the day after.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that that's a it's an interesting hypothesis because we know that first and foremost, reactive oxygen species and like, you know, oxidative stress is a huge part of what you're dealing with as your body responds to sort of like systemic inflammation from the alcohol. So something that's an antioxidant definitely could reasonably be beneficial. And we also know that hydrogen gas, in large part produced by the microbiome, is one of the major ways that your body generally deals with oxidative stress. So, I haven't looked into the science specifically of a hydrogen tablet and whether or not that's delivering a physiologically relevant amount or anything like that. But I think that it's a reasonable hypothesis. It'd be interesting to see. In terms of electrolytes and hydration, I will say that I'd love to address this a little bit. The science on that is really, really interesting. So it turns out that even though we know that alcohol definitely does bind to and affect and inhibit the antidiuretic hormone, which causes you to notice that you pee a lot, it turns out that actually most of the increased urination is just due to the fact that you are increasing your fluid intake. So, you know, drinking like, say like three kind of beers would be, or is like, if you drink three glasses of water in quick succession, you probably also pee a lot as well. So there's a lot of data out there to show that you actually at most really only pee one extra time. We see this additional urine flow right as your blood sugar and your blood alcohol initially spikes. But then it normalizes relative to somebody who's drinking the same amount of another fluid. And so the biochemical markers of dehydration, like vasopressin and things that we normally see with other things that cause dehydration are not actually present when we drink and the next day in high numbers, which is really, really interesting. And so that's not to say that electrolytes and hydration aren't a good idea. Like your liver and your kidneys are working overtime to deal with this like toxin that you're putting into your body. And so keeping your blood volume high with fluids is valuable. It's sort of like a nuanced kind of point here, but you're actually not combating dehydration at all. And I think that like we all probably know that at the deepest level, right? That like things that make you dehydrated don't feel like how alcohol makes you feel, right? And like also if you kind of wake up feeling not great the next day, typically, you know, the thing that would normally make you feel better, which is a glass of water or two, doesn't really seem to help with kind of that next day misery. So, while really I definitely would advocate for hydration and stuff, it's kind of one of these like, you know, misconceptions around like dehydration.
I'm glad you brought that up. And by the way, unless you're one of those people who's vaping or using nicotine products while you drink, which makes you pee like a racehorse. But I think about that study. I think it was in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research like 7 or 8 years ago that compared beer consumption post-exercise with Gatorade, and I think they were looking at urine-specific gravity and hydration markers, and they found that beer essentially hydrated you to the same extent as Gatorade with a similar post-exercise recovery boost. Again, like proceed at your own risk, and I don't necessarily endorse beer post-exercise, but it is interesting. You're right. I had forgotten about that study.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's been several. I mean, there's studies dating back all the way to 1942 that show like relative urine output. A lot of studies in rugby players in the 70s who were drinking alcohol after their, sport and stuff like that. And exactly, you know, there's a lot of really interesting studies about like alcohol inhibiting kind of sort of creatine cycling and testosterone and things like that. So recovery from exercise after alcohol recovery inhibits kind of recovery. But the dehydration element of it is basically the observation that we know that alcohol inhibits the antidiuretic hormone. And we also just observationally notice that we pee a lot when we drink. It led to this hypothesis that became sort of like fact in a lot of people's brain that alcohol causes dehydration. But interestingly, it doesn't, you're basically more than compensating for the inhibitory effects with the amount of, beer is 95% water with the amount of fluid that you're already drinking.
Yeah, shattering so many myths. Hey, so now that you have this secret Batman lab where you can take probiotic strains and genetically engineer them with DNA, do you think you'll ever make anything else besides just equipping people to drink more responsibly?
Yes, definitely. I'm glad you phrased that first product that way, right? The goal here is not, and you mentioned earlier, it's like, the goal is not around like irresponsible drinking at all. The goal is like, it is much more around the idea that like drinking is a normal part of our social interactions. It should not hopefully have an effect on sort of the next day, like all of your healthy habits and routines that you've been building and you're working so hard for, right, the next day. So the idea that if you go out and enjoy a holiday party or a happy hour with your friends, that you still make your morning workout the next day, or you still kind of stick to your healthy habits and routines the next day. And so it's very much like plugging into other responsible behaviors you're doing around drinking. And that's really what this product is intended for. And so with that in mind, right, like the goal of the company as a whole was never to kind of like, solve everybody's kind of next day misery after drinking. That ended up just being a really cool kind of first application of a technology that I'm really excited about, which is the idea that we can genetically engineer probiotics to do very specific, useful, beneficial things. Right now, we sort of just take bacteria that are, for the most part, are leftovers of the food and dairy industry. We mine them out of the ground, and then we say like, hey, eat this bacteria, and I hope that one of these 3,000 functions that it performs is going to be useful to you in some way. And so, your microbiome is different than mine, and so maybe it will, maybe it won't. And the idea that we can take that and we can actually engineer it to like overlay a function that we know is valuable, like this to me seems obvious and sort of the next generation of probiotic that is really like very specific and tailored to people's needs. And I'm really excited about that. And so, when I was looking for applications of the tech, I noticed early on when I pitched some things that I thought were interesting, kind of got a lot of glazed over eyes. They were sort of scientific. But then when I sort of pitched something that people really understood, sort of the next day effects of drinking, and it was sort of like this unresolved problem, and there was very nice visceral readout of efficacy so people could try it and feel the benefit, then that was why it made sense as kind of like an introduction to the world of this technology, right? So when we launched our first product in 2019, it was the world's first ever genetically engineered probiotic of any kind to go to market. And so we really wanted to do right by that technology and make sure that people were really excited about it and believed in it and could really feel the benefit of it. But ultimately, we believe that there are, countless, like hundreds or thousands of different things that you can do with this to improve somebody's day and improve somebody's life. And so we are building all kinds of products to do all sorts of things. So genetically engineering the bacteria to perform functions that kind of help with every aspect of your day, from if it's getting better nutrition from the food you're eating, if it's dealing with some of the unavoidable sort of toxic elements that are in our water or in the air or in processed food, that things that are just impossible to avoid in modern society, or the things that can maybe help you recover better from very normal, healthy, responsible behavior. So exercise is great, but obviously causes an inflammatory response, which can delay kind of benefits or like kind of knock you off your routines. Occasional poor sleep and sort of that inhibiting your ability to function, if we can help with dealing with that. And so there are so many things that basically that biologically or biochemically can happen in your body that a bacteria already is part of. And so we can kind of interrupt or intervene in a lot of these kind of biological processes to make products for sleep and mood and function and nutrition and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, do one that'll make dipeptidopeptidase, help people break down gluten. And call it G-biotics. Actually, no, call it B-biotics. Name it after me, like you named yours after you. Call it the B-biotics for helping you fare at an Italian restaurant much better.
Yeah, we our goal is to I think that we can make products that basically help people deal with a modern life, and hopefully they're all that people are all just they kind of can pick and choose what's going to help with the kind of things we're dealing with. So Italian restaurants on the menu for you.
And, maybe we can make one. Put in my special request, my feature request. Hey, this is all fascinating. You know, for people who want to try this stuff out, I know we've got some discount codes and things like that for Zbiotics, I should say. If you go to the show notes at bengreenfieldlife.com/zpodcast.
That's right. bengreenfieldlife.com/zpodcast.
Zpodcast. I will link to Zbiotics. I'll include a special discount code for you guys, links to other articles and podcasts I've done about alcohol and drinking and making your cocktails and ketone cocktail alternatives and all sorts of stuff. So I'll make the show notes nice and juicy for you. Again, at bengreenfieldlife.com/zpodcast. Zach, thanks so much for coming on the show, man. This is just fascinating. I love this stuff.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was a blast to talk about this, and I appreciate having a really cool science conversation.
All right, folks, I'm Ben Greenfield. Zach Abbott from Zbiotics. Signing out. Show notes are at bengreenfieldlife.com/zpodcast. Thanks for listening.
All right, folks. I realize this might not be for everybody, but let's say you want to spend a private, immersive weekend with me, during which you'll get to experience complete optimization for your health, longevity, fitness, nutrition, supplementation, biohacking, blood work, biomarkers, you name it, all in a private, intimate, one-on-one environment with yours truly. During a two-day experience, I will teach you everything. You will be my Padawan. I will be your Obi-Wan. I believe I got those Star Wars references right. Anyways, I will help you customize and optimize your food, your exercise, your air, your light, your water, your electricity, your biology, your biomarkers, and much more. So during this two-day experience, you'll spend 6 to 7 hours each day walking, talking, reviewing, immersed in Q&A with me, and being taught and mentored with a full follow-up report and recommendation list prepared for you at the end of your VIP experience. Now, these are flexible. We have an option for you to come to me and spend an immersive weekend in my home with me. We also have the option for me to travel to you and spend a private, immersive health optimization weekend with you. If you are interested in this offering, simply go to bengreenfieldcoaching.com. There's a button there where you can click through to see all your different coaching options with me, including this brand new offering of a private, immersive weekend health optimization experience. So check it out, bengreenfieldcoaching.com. I'm taking on about 3 to 4 of these over the course of the next year. So if you want to get in and reserve your spot, go to bengreenfieldcoaching.com. Want free access to comprehensive show notes, my weekly roundup, cutting-edge research and articles, my top recommendations for everything that you need to hack your life, and much more? Visit bengreenfieldlife.com. In compliance with the FTC guidelines, please assume the following about links and posts on this site. Most of the links going to products are often affiliate links, of which I receive a small commission from sales of certain items, but the price is the same for you, and sometimes I even get to share a unique and somewhat significant discount with you. In some cases, I might also be an investor in a company I mention. I'm the founder, for example, of Keon LLC, the makers of Keon-branded supplements and products, which I talk about quite a bit. Regardless of the relationship, relationship. If I post or talk about an affiliate link to a product, it is indeed something I personally use, support, and with full authenticity and transparency, recommend in good conscience. I personally vet each and every product that I talk about. My first priority is providing valuable information and resources to you that help you positively optimize your mind, body, and spirit. And I'll only ever link to products or resources, affiliate or otherwise, that fit within this purpose. So there's your fancy legal disclaimer.